Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dov Altman. I'm the Executive Vice President for Canadian Friends of Bar-Ilan University. And on behalf of Torah in Motion, I'd like to thank you all for coming out this morning. And I'd like to thank Torah in Motion for bringing one of our best and brightest, Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger, to speak this morning. Dr. Adam Furziger is a Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Fellow in Jewish Studies at Bar-Ilan University, where he teaches and serves as Associate Director in the Graduate Program in Contemporary Jewry. He has lectured and published extensively on Jewish religious denominations and their ideologies, modern Jewish identity formation, the history of the modern rabbinate, American Orthodoxy, and the encounter between halakha and contemporary social realities. His first book, Exclusion and Hierarchy, Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergence of Modern Jewish History, was published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, It was published by the University of Pennsylvania, and in his capacity, a senior research fellow at Bar-Ilan's Rappaport Center for the Assimilation Research. He has authored major studies on the role of rabbis in confronting assimilation and on the community kollel as a cutting-edge framework in American Jewish life. Prior to embarking on a full-time academic career at Bar-Ilan, he served as 7 years as the founding director of Bar-Ilan's Mechina for New Immigrants and as rabbi at Bet Benyamin Synagogue in Kfar Saba. A native of Riverdale, New York, he has graduated from the SAR Academy of Ramat's Upper School and studied at Beit Midrash LaTorah in Jerusalem, Yeshivat Har Tzion in Gush. He received his B.A. and M.A. in Rabbinical Ordination from Yeshiva University and his Ph.D. summa cum laude from Bar-Ilan. He and his wife, Naomi, moved to Israel in 1987. They live with their 6 wonderful children in Kfar Saba, where they involved in activities aimed at providing religious and education services to Jews from a broad spectrum of backgrounds. It is my pleasure to introduce my friend and one of our best, Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger.
Dov, thank you very much. And he forgot to say that we make really good barbecues. You're all invited. He's been there. So I don't know if my kids are I think my kids are wonderful, but I certainly think that they like to eat good steak. So, okay, so that you know, right? Okay, it's very nice to be here. And we're going to be studying some very intensive sources very shortly. I have to tell you, I like to move around, and I feel a little bit encumbered by this microphone, but I understand that everything is being taped so that they have it on the website. So I apologize. I feel a little bit funny with this, but I thought it was better than just standing there like this, okay? So please bear with me in my own discomfort. Okay. So I think this is the first session, and it's unclear to me how much background people have about Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So I'm just going to very, very briefly just give a few bio bullets so we know who we're talking about, and then we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of our subject, and I'm going to give out some source sheets. Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch lived from 1808 to 1888. It's close to 89, so it's 200 plus years that we're celebrating. And he was born in Hamburg, northwestern Germany, and was educated in a traditional Jewish home, but in a place where reform had begun to emerge. So he's very aware of the trends that had begun to develop from a young age. He later studied with some important rabbis, most prominently Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger, the Aruch Laner, where he got his smicha, his ordination. He then moved on to the University of Bonn, where he studied for just 1 year, but studied history, philosophy, and also was very active in Jewish life there among the young students. One of his colleagues and friends and cohorts there was a man by the name of Abraham Geiger, who later became the most prominent German reform rabbi. So we have the two probably most dynamic mavericks in the religious leadership of Germany in the 19th century, who at a young age organized workshop for Jewish life in there on campus. And each of them is exploring, is struggling with how to solve the questions of Jewish survival and Jewish development in emancipatory Germany. And they each come up with different solutions. One, the neo-Orthodox solution of Hirsch. The other, the reform of Geiger. There are a lot of differences. There are also a lot of similarities. And that's not going to be the focus of our discussion, but it's very fascinating. And we may allude to some of those things, actually. In my second lecture, when I talk about Hirsch's attitude towards the state of the land of Israel and proto-Zionism, I guess you'd call it, there I will be mentioning some of the parallels to the reform approach to the chosen people, etc. In any case, in 1851, after being the chief rabbi of Moravia, he moves on to Frankfurt. He's hired by a small startup Orthodox community that was in the process of gaining its independence from the Gemeinde, from the umbrella Jewish community of Frankfurt. In Europe, traditionally from pre-modern times, Jews were organized not in synagogal communities, but rather as one community with a board, Parnassim, with Rashi Kila, heads of the Kila, with one rabbi, one Beit Din, one religious court, and usually only one synagogue. There's often, as we're going to see, sometimes a cherem, excommunication writ, against starting a second synagogue. What happens in Germany is in many communities, including in Frankfurt, as reform grows, the reform, often a very affluent people, gain control of communal life, and the Orthodox started to feel squeezed. They started to feel that they couldn't conduct synagogue life, they couldn't have the privileges that they previously had, and they were losing their religious freedom. That's how they perceived it, and they began a process of trying to create alternative organs for religious life. Hirsch was the biggest proponent of this, as we will see, and from 1851, he was the rabbi of the IRG, the Israelitische Religiongesellschaft, which in 1876 gained full independence, became a separate community, an Ausstrichsgemeinde, a totally separate corporation with no official relationship whatsoever to the general community, to the Gemeinde. And that was a very controversial act. That act became one of his clarion calls, and he demanded that the ERG people would resign from the general community. Some did, some didn't. And another Orthodox community was started under the leadership of Rabbi Marcus Horowitz, which was part of the community. So you have in Frankfurt, from 1876, you actually have a Gemeinde, which entails within it a what's called Gemeinde Orthodoxa, Orthodox Jews who are under the auspices of the general community, and a Reform synagogue and community under the auspices of the general community, separate from that, you have this independent community, the Hirschian community, which has all the functions of a separate community. By itself, a chaver kadisha and a mikvah, a ritual bath, synagogue, of course, rabbi, religious court, nursing home, you name it. So, the legacy of Hirsch that we are going to be focusing on for this discussion is his legacy as a separatist, as someone who feels that the solution to Jewish survival, or certainly to survival of Judaism, in what he perceived as its authentic form, was for the Orthodox Jews to create their own completely independent entity so that they could create an ideal framework. Now, what's the paradox, just briefly, before we get into our sources? The paradox is that this is not what most of you who have heard about Hirsch know about him. What you know about Hirsch is the maverick, Torah im Derech Eretz, the man who, in opposition to almost all of the Orthodox rabbis in his day, this man says there is no conflict between Torah, between Halakha, and modern political, cultural life. That the ideal Jew is the Mensch Yisrael. Mensch being human being, Yisrael being the particularistic Jew. And that is a synthesis. That is a healthy, ideal combination. In Hirsch's perception of things, all the years that the Jews lived in the Yiddish Agassa, on the Jewish street, and other than in commerce, were really not interacting in an intensive way with the non-Jewish society. Everyone else, most of the rabbis thought, well, sometimes we were persecuted, but generally speaking, that was a good thing, because that's how Jews survived. Jews survived because they were Am Levadad Yishkon, that they lived alone. And that was the way it goes. And most of the Orthodox rabbis were extremely challenged, were extremely afraid of the introduction of modern life, of political emancipation, which entailed Jews becoming more integrated into society. And, the classic one is the Chatam Sofer, who was Frankfurt-born, but then moved to Hungary, who declares, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. That which is new is biblically forbidden. That the modern world is the antithesis of Torah, and what we must do is create, what we say in Hebrew, shachpatzim. We have to create bulletproof vests. We have to create all sorts of mechanisms for protecting ourselves, for completely distancing the Torah community from the rest of certainly non-Jewish life, as well as non-Orthodox Jewish life. So here is this interesting paragraph. The paradox. Hirsch, Sofer is consistent. Sofer believes in separating from non-Jewish culture, from contemporary culture, social, educational, cultural, economic, economics a little different, life, as well as separating from Jews who have distanced themselves from halakha and from traditional Jewish culture. Whereas Hirsch has this tension in his very being, where he seems to be, if we were to be non-exact, we would say he sounds like modern Orthodox in his theology or in his philosophy, and socially Haredi, right? That is the combination. And in other lectures that I've given, I've talked about how it is that he managed or he navigated those two seemingly oppositional aspects of his persona and his worldview. In this discussion, after that short preface, I want to look at the roots of the separatist aspect of Hirsch. I want to look at where does that come from, or is he manifesting in his 25-year campaign to totally take his followers out of the general umbrella of Jewish life? Is it something completely new, or can we see some precursors? Can we see some the roots of this? So for that purpose, I would like to give out some source sheets, and it would be very helpful if there would be one or two people who would be happy to take for their section. So I'm going to give you half, and I'm going to give, well, maybe. Could you mind distributing them here? So we'll just give a minute for everyone to get a copy. I mentioned. What? You know, while we're here, I'll just mention that Hirsch had a distinct advantage. For those of you who are involved in community building, the myth is that when he got to Frankfurt, there were only 11 people in that ER gay community. In truth, there were a few more. But regardless of how many were in that community, one of them you may have heard of, his name was, I think that's all I've got, so you might have to double up. You see, always photocopy, I didn't photocopy them, but a little less than you expect so that you can, feels good, right? Did you get one? Well, just one second. The person who was a key to Hirsch's success in Frankfurt in creating an independent community was named Wilhelm von Rothschild. Okay? So it doesn't hurt if you're in a small community to have one Rothschild who is the only one in the whole family who's actually observant. Although, just to take it around before we get to our sources, while you peruse them, Hirsch was so, you can not like some of his stuff, or you can resonate to it, however you view it, that's your position, but he was so intellectually consistent that Rothschild's daughter fell in love with a non-observant, reform-oriented Jewish banker. And Rothschild asked Hirsch to perform the wedding, and Hirsch refused. Now, we could look at that, you know, again, from two perspectives. But I'm just taking the perspective that this man is an ideologue, and he goes, the way we say in Hebrew, ad hasof, until the end, rosh bakir, his head into the straight. He believes in his view, and he's willing to put his relationship to Rothschild on line, and they did become alienated because of it. Interesting. You had a question. I may not answer it, but please, go ahead. Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, what was the Jewish community like at that time? It's not what we call an al regel achad question, but I'll just try to give it a little background. Up till basically the early 19th century, sometime in the 18th century. It's hard to give a date, but in a situation. What we call pre-modern times, traditional society was a society where in each locale where there were Jews were incorporated as an independent group. There was no such thing as citizenship. There were monarchs, or there were noblemen, or there were various types of magnates, leaders, who controlled areas. We're talking about a semi-feudal society. And Jews were given permission by the ruler to live in that place. And the Jews had to pay taxes. They had to produce certain economic advantages for the ruler, and that's why they came in. In return, Jews had self-rule. We think the State of Israel is the first time that Jews had self-rule. It's not exactly true. On a political level, on a military level, that is absolutely true. But in terms of self-rule, autonomy, right, which is a word that's often discussed in terms of the Palestinians, Jews living in Europe, for example, and that's our focus here, Jews had a great degree of self-rule. They had a little government. They had the judiciary, that was the rabbis. They had the legislative and the executive, which was the Parnassim, which was the communal board. And they decided communal policy. They had the one synagogue. And all the Jews who lived in a locale, if they wanted to remain full-standing members of that community, they had to accept the laws that were set down by the Jewish community. They also had a foreign minister. It's called a shtadlan, who was the person who was the intercessor with the non-Jewish rulers. But what this means is, just to be very, very brief and very, very specific, that if a Jew did not fulfill financial obligations to the community, or there was a business dispute between Schwartz and Cohen, they didn't go to the non-Jewish court. They went to the Beit Din. Now, what if the person refused to pay the money that he owed after a ruling? Well, there was a series of punishments. Nidui, Cherem Katan, Cherem Gadol. You can't come to synagogue. You can't get an aliyah. We won't make a shidduch for your daughter. We won't do business with you. Ultimately, a Jew could be excommunicated totally. Now, today that doesn't seem like such a threatening thing, unless you're very, very committed to your Hasidic community, etc. But in a voluntary community like today, but in a community where there is no, what my teacher Jacob Katz called, a neutral society, that is very threatening, because the only choice is to becoming Christian, right? So if you want to be Jewish, you have to be at least publicly observant. You have to be willing to follow the public rules. That's how it was in the late 18th century, 19th century in Germany, because of Napoleonic Wars, because of the French Revolution, which affected Germany, because of the rise of Enlightenment, etc. These things seem to change. So what changes eventually is that Jews become citizens, and Jews become part of German society or the German state in which they live in, and they follow those rules on civil issues. However, in regard to internal religious life, the functions of the Jewish community, such as hospital, which was a Jewish function, not a general function, registering births, nursing home, restaurants, butcher, synagogue, rabbi, etc., that remained like the remnants of that traditional Jewish community. So when Hirsch says, I'm going to buck that, he's saying, I am rejecting the way Jews, the last remnants of the way Jews have lived for centuries. And I am creating something alternative, a community of the faithful. A community of, not of all the Jews in Frankfurt, but only the Jews in Frankfurt who are committed to an Orthodox life in a world of voluntarism, in a world of what Peter Berger calls a modern world is characterized by choice. In a world in which a Jew no longer has to, is not coerced, does not have to express their Jewish identity through fulfilling the mitzvot of Shabbat, of Kashrut, of Tarat HaMishpacha, Jewish family purity, etc. In such a world in which a Jew can be Reform, can be secular, can be Zionist, can be cultural, can be gastronomical. In such a world, Judaism becomes voluntary, an issue of choice. And here says, in such an environment, those who want to be Orthodox, come with me. Everybody else, go your own way and take a look at the first source now. Okay? So the first source, I took a really inflammatory one, but he wrote this, just to emphasize how Hirsch's perception is a new one. So orthodoxy is presented as the continuity of tradition, but orthodoxy is a reaction to the modern world. It's a response to a world of choice. It's a response to threats from the outside. It's a response to the possibility of alternatives. Look what Hirsch says. In his essay, which is called The Kihila, The Community. No matter how large the number of dissenting brethren among whom they dwell, no matter how small the number of those who they can count among their own, Torah true Jews have no alternative. They must adjust themselves to their Torah responsibilities as if they were the only Jews in the locality. No one else matters. Even in the smallest localities, where only two or three families dwell together, they have to set up their own ritual slaughterer and their other institutions they need for their life as a Jewish community. Should this be any less possible for a minority of Torah Jews because they are not dwelling in the midst of 1,000 Christian families, but in the midst of 1,000 un-Jewish families? In other words, in medieval times, of course, two, three families would have their own slaughterer, their own activities. But here, there are lots of Jews, but he calls them un-Jewish Jews. In other words, because they are not observant, it's the same dynamic that was the medieval dynamic now being transferred to a modern framework. Should they assume that this difference in environment reduces their obligation to make independent provisions for their own religious duties, therefore join forces with the Torah and establish Kilat Yaakov, the congregation of Jacob, no matter how small. Every band of brothers, small numbers but sincere and united for the sake of truth, bears within it the seeds of victory and the future. And especially in our present era, it is particularly important that we unite and remain united in loyalty to Jewish law. The smaller the number of the faithful, the more encouraging is the experience, that one has comrades who share one's loyalty. So this is the community of the faithful. This is a vision. And again, without trying to balance it, maybe we'll have time for questions, and I'll explain how I understand this seeming paradox. But this is if you read this and you didn't know that the same person, you know, read Kant, and the same person was interested in contemporary philosophy, and this person was influenced, liked opera and theater, and didn't even require that they wore a kippah in his school during secular studies, and dressed according to the height of fashion of his time, you would be absolutely positive that a Satmar Hasid wrote this, right? That's what it sounds like. It sounds like something that you would hear from the most separatist, the most insular, enclavist type of modern Jewish group. Sectarianism. That is what it comes out of here. And again, there is that paradox that I'm mentioning. But the question is, did Hirsch make this up? So I spent a lot of time trying to understand this issue and trying to understand the roots of this issue as part of a broader study that I wrote, the book Exclusion and Hierarchy, where I tried to understand the development of Orthodox non-observant relations in the modern period. How, once there was a significant non-observant population, and in Germany in 1850 there were already half the Jews of Germany weren't observant, by 1900 we're talking about 80%. So how did those who remained committed to halachic observance navigate their relationship, and how did they develop their own self-identity through their definition of this other, of this brother who is an other, this Jew who is different? Okay, so that's the book that I wrote. And here I came across what I believe to be an unbelievable source. Through what you do in research, you sit and you go through books, and I was reading books and books and books of rabbinic responsa, and one of the important ones that I came across was that of Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi. Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi was a very interesting figure who lived in a lot of places: Amsterdam, Saloniki, Hamburg. He was an Ashkenazic Jew from Lithuanian background who lived mostly in Germany. Tremendous Talmid Chacham, tremendous scholar, but he also studied in Sephardic yeshivas. And therefore, he called himself Chacham, not Rabbi, which is a Sephardic appellation. And he was regarded very well, not only by Ashkenazic communities, but by Sephardic communities. And often when there would be a debate within a Sephardic community, they would turn to Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi as a sort of insider-outsider to adjudicate that debate. And that's exactly what we're going to see now. By the way, those who may not have heard of him, a lot of people have heard of him recently because they traveled to Israel, and he's the one who gave the heter, the permission for out of Israel Jews who come to spend Passover or Sukkot in Israel to keep one day. So a lot of people, it's really funny, you know, people also, the Chacham Tzvi, you know, also everyone knows the Chacham Tzvi. What do they know about him? One thing, you know, it's always that way. Anyway, he did a lot of other things. Among them, he was the father of a very famous rabbi by the name of Rabbi Jacob Emden, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the Yavetz, Cedar Yavetz, who was one of the most prolific, important and controversial figures of late 18th century Central Europe. He died in 1876, and worth an entire Torah in Motion conference just on Emden and the Emden Ivishus controversy. I'd be happy to come. Rabbi J.J. Schachter from YU, who wrote his doctorate on Jacob Emden, will come. We'll have a lot of fun. We'll also be a little bit shocked, but you know, we have to approach the truth. That's what this is about. Okay, so Chacham Tzvi tells us in Tshuva 38, in Responsum 38 of his collection of halachic decisions, of an interesting event that took place, and I'll tell you in advance before we read it, that it took place in London around the year 1705. The first part of this essay that we have there, that Responsum, it's actually written in Portuguese, in Hebrew letters, and when I looked at it, I was, you know, thought it was Chinese, and, you know, no matter how many languages you learn when you're in scholarship, you always have a surprise. But luckily, after a few lines of Portuguese, he actually translates it into Rabbinic Hebrew. And when I started reading the Rabbinic Hebrew, I was shocked, because this is 1705, 300 plus years ago, in a time when the assumption is that at least libriut, that in the assumption is that all the Jews are observant, or the ones who aren't observant are deviants who people don't talk about them. And all of a sudden, I come across a description of a Jewish community that sounds modern. It sounds like what we're used to ourselves, which is people come to synagogue, maybe less so. I think, unfortunately today, but certainly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you had a lot of Orthodox synagogues, which not all the people who came to synagogue were themselves observant. I'm saying it's good to be observant, but on the other hand, the idea that an Orthodox synagogue has become more Hirshian, right, is sort of interesting, and maybe we'll get to that in terms of the implications. But that's a process that's gone on in North America, and that's another field of study of mine. But right now we're working on the background, the history. Of course, there are implications. So here we go. We're in 1705, and this is what he describes. Men from the Sephardic community, and that's important, who were awoken by fear of God to leave their own congregation when they saw that sons of our nation who perform acts that should not take place among the Israelites. So a group of Sephardic Jews decide to take off and leave their community and go to another synagogue, which if you look at the Hebrew, you'll see it was an Ashkenazi shul. When they see that there are people in the Sephardic synagogue who are not so observant. These people are not observant, but they attend prayer services there and go up to read the Torah and participate in all the other rituals that are customary in the synagogue, this being a thing that they cannot accept. So a small group of Sephardic Jews say, hey, what's going on? It turns out, when we read later, that there are Mechalei Shabbat Parhesia. There are public Sabbath desecrators, 1705, not 2009, 1705, public Sabbath desecrators, who come to synagogue regularly, okay? And they're not shunted, they're actually given aliyot. They're called up to the Torah. It's a Sephardic shul, so they call it reading the Torah, but it means getting an aliyah, saying the blessing on the Torah. And they say, what's going on here? We don't do that. How can that be? And they say, if that's the case, we're leaving this synagogue. We are going to the Ashkenazi shul. Now, this is not just like today, you don't like your shul, you don't like your rabbi, you go to a different shul. Again, until the Ashkenazim came along, there was only one synagogue in London. It was the Sephardic synagogue that had been started by what we call former Anusim, former conversos, or what's pejoratively called Maranos, Jews who had lived secretly as Christians in Spain and Portugal due to the persecutions and inquisitorial organization, and eventually had found their way out of the Iberian Peninsula, had moved to places like London, Hamburg, Amsterdam. Amsterdam's more familiar to a lot of you, and had reacquainted themselves with Jewish life. And they brought in sometimes North African Sephardic rabbis to reorganize their community. One of the bylaws of that synagogue is that absolutely, positively, you cannot start or join any other synagogue. If you do, we put you in Chayram. We excommunicate you. So it's right there in the books. So now you can tell me, you can say, but how did the Ashkenazim start a shul? The answer is, for the Sephardim, and this will become very relevant here, Ashkenazim don't count. Because this is what we call the Ummah Sephardit, the Sephardic nation. The only thing I compare it to, Lahavdil, that it's like Holocaust survivors. The sense of communitas, the sense of common survival, of common destiny that pervaded the Sephardic community, and you can see it sometimes till today if you're familiar with Sephardic life, is a type of ethnicity. There's a type of ethnicity which is very strong to the point where they didn't care that an Ashkenazi shul was opened up. They also didn't like when Ashkenazim came to their shul, because then they'd have to give them an aliyah. In fact, they would prefer to give an aliyah to someone who didn't keep Shabbat, who was Sephardic, than someone who did keep Shabbat, who was Ashkenazic. They'd even prefer that their children marry a non-observant Sephardic Jew than marry an observant Ashkenazic Jew, even if they were observant themselves. So I'm starting to sort of develop the two polar or the two typologies that we're going to see here. I hope people are following me. I'm going to hear your question, but if I choose not to answer, just so they can move with the time, you'll understand. Okay, so the second part I'm gonna get to. The first part is important, though, you know, it doesn't really change things. But yes, These were Sephardic merchants who the King Charles was happy to have, and the previous king happy to have, because it was the time of the growth of mercantilism. They came in as Christians, but England was a more permissive society because of the Church of England. It wasn't Catholic, therefore there was no Inquisition. Similarly, Amsterdam was, Holland was Protestant, and therefore Catholics were persecuted, not Jews, actually. So these are the places they went to. But very quickly, they had secret synagogues, then eventually the king gave them permission. By the time 1705 comes along, about 35 years, there is an official Jewish community, but only the Sephardic community. The Ashkenazic community is poor, is people who have come from Eastern Europe, and, you know, in Hebrew we say, Sephardim lo samim lehem. In other words, no one pays attention to them because they are really not part of the, you know, in fact, they're an embarrassment in a certain way to the Ashkenazi, to the Sephardic community, who are very elitist and very economically developed. Okay. So, Chacham Tzvi is asked a halachic question. These people come to him and they say, we want to be frum. We want to be more observant. We want to be vociferous in our observance. And the community, the Sephardic community, has threatened us with cherem, with excommunication, because we want to leave the shul because we think the people in the synagogue aren't sufficiently observant, or that they're giving kavod, they're giving honor to people in the community who do not reflect the values of the community. So the question is, would you support our position? So we're going to get to his answer momentarily. But just to expand a little bit, so who are these people? Well, if you look on the next page for a second, you'll see something interesting. You see, Yosef Kaplan's a very important scholar of this whole issue of what's called, often referred to as the Western Sephardic Diaspora. Yosef Kaplan tells us, well, we won't read the quote, he says that there were different types of Sephardic Jews. It's sort of like what happens after you've gone through a trauma. He said some Sephardic Jews arrived in London and were told that to be a Jew means to keep Torah and mitzvot, the commandments, and the halacha, etc. And they did it. They learned it. They had Brit Milah because they hadn't had one before. They began to do all the things that the rabbis told them to do. There was another group of Sephardic Jews who were totally on the other side. Many of them people who remained in business contacts with people in Portugal and Spain, who didn't get it. They said, Judaism, what does it mean to be a Jew? This is really interesting. Well, when I was in Portugal and I was at least outwardly Christian, I wasn't, what did it mean to be a Jew? It meant that I only believed in the Old Testament, not the New Testament. And it meant I didn't believe in the Trinity. Why? Because even though they understood they weren't Christian, their theological conception was a Christian conception. In other words, they perceived religion as being confessional. And therefore, they thought the difference between being a Jew is like the difference between being a Protestant and being a Catholic. Okay? A few little rituals, and basically, what is your theology? They didn't understand that Judaism, like Islam, and as opposed to Christianity, are primarily legal-oriented religions where the observance is a central manifestation of one's identity and one's service of God. So they arrived in London. They say, okay, I'm Jewish. I reject the Old Testament. You know, I'm not going to keep Christian holidays. But they weren't willing, both for economic and for, you know, conceptual reasons, to start keeping mitzvot, almost at all. So they were sort of socially Jewish because that was their ethnic group. Not that different than the way they had been when they lived in Portugal or Spain. And by the way, when did I start to really understand this? When I was the director of the Mechina L'Olim in Bar-Ilan, and I was there in the 90s when thousands and thousands of Russian-speaking students came to Israel. And you know, what did it mean to be a Jew in Russia? It meant that you read Pushkin, that you valued education, you liked to go to theater, you liked to go to ballet, you were cultural elite and stuff like that. And, you know, all these Russians, whether they were even the ones, many who were halakhically Jewish, arrived in Israel, and the Israelis looked at them when they opened their stores where they sold ham and stuff like that. I said, Goyim. And the Russians looked at the Israelis, who are not, the majority of them, not known to be, you know, culturally, you know, necessarily into high culture, and they said, they looked at the Israelis, and what did they say? Goyim. Okay? It's interesting, the disconnect. So that was very helpful to me in understanding what happens to these Sephardic Jews who arrive and are supposed to be normativized into Jewish life. Okay, so then there's this third middle group. That's the ones who are coming to shul. They come to synagogue. They want to be part of the community, but they're not willing to sort of go the whole way. They want to be part of things. They're in the middle. And the Sephardic community, their leaders, their rabbis say, we want you in. We want you to be part of things. We're going to honor you, not just for economic reasons, because you're us. And we're not going to be so picky, because if we're so picky, we all survive this. It's complicated. Let's maintain solidarity. And these other people in the community are saying, we learned halacha. We've been now in the community for a few years. We've been studying the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch. And how can this be? The Talmud, strictly speaking, says, Mechalel Shabbat Befresia ke goy l'chol davar. A public Sabbath is greater, is comparable to a Gentile in every way. Now, that's not true in as far as marriage, divorce, etc. is concerned, but that's a very strong comment. These people are fundamentalists. They're just becoming involved, and they say, how can we pray with these people? Dov, how much time do I have, Dov? 10:15 finish? Okay. So, let's look at, I'll just tell you that Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi responds very interestingly. Let's take a look at the second page. Let's take a look at what he says. He rules in favor of that minority group, even though he understood the Sephardic community. And if someone should claim that it is permissible to pray with sinners until they have been explicitly communicated, excommunicated, the answer is that this only refers to occasional transgressors. This is interesting. The Ramah, Rabbi Moses Isserles, the very important 16th century Polish adjudicator who added his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, he says, if a person is not excommunicated, they count for the minyan, they count for the quorum. So people can say, these people haven't been excommunicated. Okay, so they're not so observant. What's the big deal? So he says, this is such a very important comment in terms of understanding how he perceived what the modern Jew is. What does Chacham Tzvi say? He says, those are occasional transgressors. You have a person who's really keeping the law. Here and there, maybe, you know, they catch them doing something they shouldn't. Okay, that person, you're not going to excommunicate them. You'll keep them in shul. He says, what we are facing is a new phenomenon. The normative non-observant Jew. It has never existed before. These are not occasional transgressors. These are people who have defined their lifestyle as non-observant, but not becoming Sabbatean, messianic antinomians, not becoming apostates who are on their way to Christianity. This is something that has never existed. So you can imagine, when I read this, I'm writing a book about the Orthodox approach to non-observance. Basically, you are looking at the first rabbinic source, at least in Europe, that addresses this new figure that becomes the majority of Jews in this world to this day. The normative, non-observant, but positively identifying Jew. What does he say? He says that the people who bucked the shul are right. He says, bold, a public Sabbath desecrator is as a Gentile in all ways, what I mentioned. How can it be possible for such a person to go up and read from the Torah? There is no greater desecration of God's name and dousing of the fire of religion. And anyone who is standing and present at that time in that place and does not protest will be caught up in his sins and lend support for his transgressions. So what does he say? He says, those people who went to Daven with Ashkenazim, to pray with Ashkenazim, they're totally right. Absolutely right. Now, before we get back to Hirsch in the few minutes we have left, so Rabbi Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi was a very important authority. He perceived modern, the modern world, in my opinion, he is a precursor to Hirsch, community of the faithful. Of course, we all know that Judaism is an ethno-religious unit. That means, as opposed to Christianity, where you can have Asian Christians, and you can have African Christians, and you can have South American Christians, and you can have North American Christians, Jews are an ethnic group in addition to having a common belief, common theology. That's the way it was from Sinai until about 200 years ago or 300 years ago, when all of a sudden it breaks. And some people choose the ethnicity line and some people choose the religion line. And here we're standing at the cusp of that break in these sources. When forced to choose, what does Chacham Tzvi say? Which one? Religion. Community of the faithful. Ultimately, ultimately what Judaism is about beliefs and about observance, practice, and therefore, I think the people who left are right. But there are also, but the Sephardic community also has its rabbis. They also have their leaders. Aren't they also authoritative? Don't they also have a reasonable opinion? And they take the other position. They say, of course we want to educate our community to be more committed, more observant. But are we going to do that at the cost of alienating a significant number of the people who are part of our tribe? People who have gone through terrible, terrible traumas, who have survived generations, multiple generations of living as secret Jews and outward conversos and have been persecuted. And somehow, this Sherita Pleita, this remaining group, succeeded in returning to Jewish life and views Jewish life positively. They come to synagogue. They want to be a part of things. Are we going to say you can't get an aliyah? Are we going to say you can't be actively involved in our synagogue? And they say, no. Tribal solidarity, unity, the sense of family, the sense of being a part of a whole, the big tent. These cannot be sacrificed, and we have to find a way to keep people in. This debate is a debate which has gone with us Jews from that point till today. And this debate really, I think, offers a great deal of insight into many of the conflicts which take place both in the diaspora and in the state of Israel in terms of communal membership, in terms of connections between Jews. On what level do Jews connect? Of course, here it's polarity, either or, community of the faithful or Jewish solidarity. And the truth is that most people are somewhere in between. But I think these are the two modalities that people are addressing, are trying to deal with if they are committed Jews and committed to Klal Yisrael, committed to the collective Jewish people simultaneously. Now, after I studied this, and after I discovered this, and I found it interesting, and I wrote about it, I began to write about it, and thank God people found it very interesting, I was reading some German newspapers that were written around 1877, just at the time when Hirsch was separating, as we recall, from the general Gemeinde, when Hirsch was creating his Auschwitz Gemeinde. And I came across something that, except that it was hard to read because it was hard German, it blew me away. You know, but once I really understood it, you know, I couldn't believe it. Okay, so let's take a look. Manfred Lehmann, who was a very important rabbi and editor of Der Israelit, the leading Orthodox organ newspaper in Germany in the second half of the 19th century. Manfred Lehmann writes a defense of Hirsch, a defense of Hirsch's separatism. And look what he says. We can also find someone who will substantiate the statement. He lived 200 years, not 200 years, really 170, 160. He lived 200 years before the Neo-Orthodox and luckily also dealt with the matter of Jews stepping out of their communities. It is no one else than the Chacham Tzvi. In his book, Shelot U'Tshuvot, one can find the following. From the outset, the Chacham Tzvi's discussion offers interesting insight, for it was written at a time in which a law regarding secession from the community was not relevant to most people. He says, we have this great Talmud Chacham, and he's giving us a takdim, he's giving us a precedent for the behavior of Hirsch. Although the author of the article mainly deals with the value and meaning of community, one cannot find any trace of particular value placed upon so-called communal peace, solidarity. The Chacham Tzvi rejected communal solidarity. The critics, those who wanted to leave the synagogue, complained that it is an assault upon their freedom of conscience if they are not permitted to separate themselves from the community. So now it's modern jargon, right? It sounds like democracy, right? The permission is not only given, but also everyone who does not protest against the Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name, is considered responsible for the sinful behavior. Hence, freedom of conscience takes precedent over remaining within one's community. That is very near Orthodox. If those who are attempting to maintain the obligatory nature of the unified community, those in the Gemeinde are trying to force us to remain part of the community, listen, we have a source. Will only attempt to perceive communal separation as the Neo-Orthodox do, they will come to recognize that it is necessary to predate the emergence of the new Orthodox order by 200 years. If the Chacham Tzvi was already Neo and also hyper-Orthodox, then it is also permissible for us, and we are proud of it. So you can imagine, you know, in Hebrew, I mentioned this yesterday in a different lecture, we used to say, Nafala Simon. The token fell, but when I tell my students that, they don't know because they all have cell phones. They don't know what those little tokens with the holes in it in Israel are. But that's what it means, you know. The Nafala Simon, like all of a sudden, I said, wow, they were using this source already then. And it all came together, full circle. So my point is that Hirsch is certainly the zenith or nadir, depending on how you perceive it, but it's certainly the ultimate development of this approach, which says community of the faithful is the ideal framework for Jewish survival and for the success of Torah and dissemination of Jewish values in a modern heterogeneous society. But this development has its roots in the earliest cases of fragmentation, the earliest cases of the emergence of a heterogeneous, complex Jewish life. And as I said to you, that's where it begins, and it hasn't ended. And if some of you, I guess the people here, were wondering, well, why are we spending a whole day studying Hirsch? Why are we studying this 19th century German Orthodox rabbi? What relevance does he have to us? Whether we like his answers, are inspired by him, are disappointed, you know, I don't like to study people who just agree with me. I want to study people who force me to think. I want to study people who pressure me. I want to study people who put me on the line and say, respond to that. You can accept it, reject it, navigate it, but you can't ignore it. I think that Hirsch is a wonderful figure for people to go through a process of learning and a process of intellectual and religious personal clarification. Thank you very much. Yes, he was a German Orthodox Jew, absolutely, yeah.
Norman Lamb, Manfred Lamb.
Okay.
You know,
yes, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Would Hirsch have been aware of the Shilas and Chubas of the Chacham Tzvi or independently came to this conclusion?
So that's a wonderful question. I think that he came to it independently. I don't think that it was like a halachist type of thing. I think it was his own architecture, his own design. But I think that There's a fancy word that people use in German, Zeitgeist. I think that we're talking about the spirit of the times that he manifests and he brings to the fore in his way.
Good question. Can you contrast the two? Because of the different Muslims? First was in a society where the Orthodox were a small minority, whereas the Chacham Tzvi was dealing with a different type of environment.
Of course, I think history does not repeat itself. And I think that people use history in that way, and that's what Manfred Lehmann is doing here. And as a historian, of course, I could tell you how the context, but I think that as we know, and by the way, if I may, I think that's one of the lessons from this, is that in a sort of, one has to be careful when you see someone say, you see, history repeats itself. You see, it was that way. Learn the history. Learn the case. See to what degree really the things resemble each other. Certainly one can learn from precedent, but one should also always be aware, as you said very astutely, that circumstances change and there are always new factors, and therefore parallels can be found, but nothing is by any means identical.